Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I used to think walking in Dublin was about getting from place A to place B. It was merely a form of transport, and a frustratingly slow one at that. Walking for pleasure was something I only enjoyed as a tourist. In a strange city, I can ramble all day, looking at the buildings, wondering about the people behind the facades. And then I got a dog. Once I began to tread the same routes daily, I realised how little I really knew them. What is the story behind this building? I'd ask myself, and sometimes the dog, as we passed yet another ornate Georgian or Victorian row, offices emptied by lockdown that were once homes to families, once warmed by fires and real lives. And then a friend mentioned the most curious local story of all. Portobello Gardens. A long-ago spectacle so fun, so garish and giddy, I found it hard to believe no trace of it lingers in my neighbourhood streets. Stretching from the canal to the South Circular Road across a 7-acre site, the Royal Portobello Gardens opened in May 1839. The concept of pleasure gardens wasn't new. The one in Marlborough Street, which closed in 1761, the duel over a woman which resulted in the death of the heir to the Earl of Meath turned out to be terrible for business, had dated back to the 12th century. At the helm of this new venture were Gilbert Sanders and William Druitt, a former curator of the Royal Zoological Society of Dublin. That's Dublin Zoo to you and me, itself only 9 years old at this time. Sanders and Druitt's announcement of their new venture in the Freeman's Journal tempted the public with a splendid dioramic view of Mount Vesuvius and the city and bay of Naples. They promised that in honour of Queen Victoria's birthday, at dusk a grand representation of the eruption of Mount Vesuvius will take place, under the direction of Mr. Jingle of the Royal Gardens, Vauxhall, London, and Mr. George Gibe, the celebrated pyrotechnicist. This launch event proved so successful that a second eruption took place days later. The whole, the newspaper reporting, on a far more extensive scale than any hitherto attempted. Within 6 months, it was renamed Portobello Zoological Gardens, advertising rare animals, many of which had never been seen in Ireland before, including a sociable vulture, a bush kangaroo, a white-headed eagle and a Bengal tigress. Alongside this menagerie, it kept up the live music, as well as the Italian connection, promising visitors the additional sight of a representation of the destruction of Pompeii and Herculaneum. Imagine, two beautiful ancient cities, their demise recreated while bemused seals and monkeys looked on across the park. The tragedy of history repeated as farce. Some of the most famous names in travelling entertainment performed there, including circus owner and equestrian Pablo Fanque, the inspiration for the Beatles song being for the benefit of Mr. Kite in 1850, and tightrope walker Charles Blondin in 1860, a year after his sensational Niagara Falls crossing. During a show in London, he carried a stove onto the rope and, suspended high above the audience, cooked omelettes, which he shared with the fans below. He didn't get to demonstrate his culinary skills in Dublin as the tightrope broke and the scaffold collapsed. Blondin escaped uninjured, but two workers died. William Druitt was dead by this time too, having fallen into the Liffey while getting off a paddle steamer. From 1858, a pyrotechnician called Kirby had the lease on Portobello Gardens. When an arsonist burnt down both Kirby's house, oh the irony, and the music hall, the resulting claims for compensation were the garden's death knell. By 1864, the area was sold for houses. The lake was drained and St. Kevin's Church, which is now in apartments, built on the newly reclaimed land. Portobello Gardens lasted almost 25 years. That's considerably longer than some contemporary fads. It wasn't the internet cafe of its day. Yet it is just as much a creature of the past, despite its familiar-sounding problems, such as complaints about traffic and pickpockets. Smoking was an issue. The public was regularly reminded it was prohibited, which between the hot air balloons and myriad pyrotechnic displays seems an eminently sensible decision. Today, in street after street of solid red brick houses, Portobello holds tight to its secrets. There is no hint it was ever the site of a lake, or home to exotic animals, or volcanic recreations. Or that in long gone summer evenings, People wandered freely till dusk on paths lit by Chinese lamps, while a band played, acrobats twirled, and fireworks the colour of jewels burst high into the Dublin skies.
For the benefit of Mr. Kite, there will be a show tonight on trampoline. The Hendersons will all be there, late of Pablo Bank is there, what a scene. Over men and horses, hoops and garters, lastly through a hog's head of real fire.
When you talk to people from Naples, a single incontestable truth very soon emerges. Naples is beautiful. For the stranger, it's a difficult concept to square with the reality. The city is dirty, dangerous, and disorganized. The traffic is chaotic. The buildings and monuments in a poor state of repair. Everywhere, the effects of the centuries-long economic crisis are visible, with young men lounging in public spaces and obvious homelessness. But Naples has always been like this to some extent. So where is the beauty? Certainly things look better from the top of Capo di Monte, from whence you can look down on the enormous bay glittering in the sunshine, or from the deck of a ferry with Vesuvius in the background. But that cannot account for the myth or truth of the beauty of Naples. Dublin too can be dirty, or London, and from a distance they too can look beautiful. But the phrase beautiful Dublin does not trip off the tongue the way Napoli Bella does. The first thing to understand is that it is the people who make Naples beautiful. Warm, welcoming, generous, smiling, self-deprecating, it is impossible not to like them. Despite the corruption of the Camorra, the Neapolitan Mafia, so graphically depicted in Roberto Saviano's book Gomorra, despite the sprawling chaos of the municipality, they are convinced that they live in a fallen paradise. When you pronounce the truth, Napoli è bella, they are immediately in love with you, if only for the brief moment of the encounter. This is as much true in the back lanes of the Spanish Quarter, are the long, fragmented street known as Spaccanapoli, as on the Via Toledo, the fashionable shopping street. If you sit in an out-of-the-way restaurant, by the way, it's almost impossible to eat badly in Naples, and smile at people, someone will engage you in conversation, and the conversation will eventually come round to the question, do you like Naples? You know the answer. The second thing to understand about Napoli Bella is that most of the songs that we think of as typically Italian, most of the really famous songs, are in fact love songs to Naples. Come Back to Sorrento, Fenesta Vascia, O Sole Mio, Santa Lucia. What's more, most of them are not actually in Italian at all, but to a greater or lesser extent in the Neapolitan language, with its thick S's, its swallowed endings, its substitutions. No city in Italy, not Rome, not Venice, certainly not Milan, has been so garlanded in song. So much so that some years ago, the mayor of Venice felt it necessary to introduce a bylaw to control the singing of the gondoliers, because whenever a tourist asked for a song, it was inevitably Neapolitan, and the traditional Venetian songs were being lost. And now it is a warm evening in June or September, and you're wandering the back streets of the Spanish Quarter, those famous streets hung with washing where the people live in ancient crumbling palazzos. If you've read Elena Ferrante or seen the series based on her book, you already know the place. The shops are opening after the siesta. People are emerging to greet each other as though they have been temporarily lost. The stones of the streets, the masonry, exude the stored warmth of the sun, but the shade is refreshing. Everywhere there are affectionate greetings. Ciao bella, ciao tesoro, or simply, uè, the local equivalent of how's it going? The smell of cooking. Naples invented pizza as a working man's sandwich. Spaghetti alla puttanesca, or spaghetti whore style, is another local dish. on such an evening, our heads full of music, partaking vicariously in the natural affection of communal life, we too are in danger of falling in love with Naples. There's really only one thing to do. Walk into that dark and tiny restaurant and ask for a table. You're their first customer of the evening. They're delighted to see you. They are astonished that you speak Italian so fluently, although they discreetly offer you the menu in English. They are ready to explain to you not only what the names of the dishes signify, but each of the ingredients and how they are cooked. If there's a question the waiter cannot answer, or if someone disputes some aspect of the recipe, he may even bring the cook out to settle it. Do not be surprised if she's the waiter's mother. This is Naples. And you can all agree on one thing. Napoli è bella. Buon appetito.
Among the many busts and statues in Dublin's Merrion Square that honour eminent names in Irish history, Oscar Wilde, Michael Collins, Henry Grattan and others, one of the square's most notable residents and one of its few celebrated females remains conspicuously absent. That is the fashion designer Sybil Connolly. There is no memorial, no record, no reminder of her presence either in the square or on the house in which she lived and worked for over 40 years. Born in Wales in January 1921 to an Irish father from Waterford and a Welsh mother, Connolly moved to Ireland at the age of 15. She was to become this country's first internationally famous and most successful fashion designer, its first female entrepreneur, and certainly the most travelled and admired. She gave Ireland its textiles and skills, a place in world fashion history. She employed 100 people in the 1950s, at a time when emigration from this country was at its highest. She elevated Irish vernacular clothing to high fashion and dressed women like Jackie Kennedy, Helena Rubinstein and Elizabeth Taylor, along with wealthy American patrons that included the Rockefellers and the Mellons. Taoiseach Jack Lynch described her as a national treasure. In her hands, Irish tweed became lighter and more colourful. Carrickmacross lace made by the nuns was cut into new shapes for blouses. Everyday red flannel became glamorous evening wear. But above all, it was pleated linen that made her name. She called her fine Georgian home the house that pleated linen built. Her first dress, to be shown in the US, consisted of 300 linen handkerchiefs in more than 5,000 pleats. It created a sensation, its greatest merit being that it was uncrushable. I was one of the last people to interview her over 10 years before her death in May 1998 and will never forget the occasion. It took place in the spring of 1986 in her mews at the rear of her house, number 71 Merrion Square, which she had purchased at the age of 35 for £9,000 in 1957 at the height of her commercial success. A further £54,000 was spent by her on its refurbishment with the help of architect Michael Scott. I was ushered in by her white-gloved butler, James Sheridan, and left to await her arrival, giving me time to take in the stylish surroundings, the Chinese Chippendale staircase, the painted wooden dining room floors, the gingham wallpapers, the carved and gilded decorative mirrors, and beyond the French windows, the garden with its fruiting fig trees and delicate cherry blossom that led up to the main house. If the impression was one of grandeur, it was certainly effective. It was another world. Her arrival in a tailored dress was full of welcoming bustle, concern, and that voice, all deep purr and disarming seductiveness. She was then 65 and a little forgotten at home in Ireland, though she had broadened her skills into other areas, designing porcelain, wallpapers, spongeware and crystal. It must be said, long before other European or American fashion designers, as well as co-authoring books on Irish gardens and crafts. In 1 year alone, one of her Tiffany prints sold 250,000 copies in Japan. That year marked the 30th anniversary of her first trip to the US. It was on the Queen Mary, and it was the worst crossing in history. When the liner finally docked in New York, the press was out in force to greet it. Swept up in the ensuing publicity, the young Irish designer became an overnight sensation, and her Irish washerwoman look, which she had so carefully contrived with its red flannel quilted petticoats, lace blouses and black shawls, immediately fired the imagination of American buyers. After that, she recalled, everything changed. I didn't have to fight anymore. Her success paved the way for other Irish designers in later years, but no one since has captured the American market in quite the same way. The sale of her house and contents in November 1998 after her death created huge interest. One day alone of the four-day viewing attracted more than 2,000 people. Prices achieved surpassed expectation. Today, her pieces can be found occasionally in auction houses or vintage sites like First Dibs, commanding prices even higher than Dior. When I last looked, of the 15 items currently on that site, there is hardly any under 1,000 euros. A classic black pleated linen dress that would not look out of place today is 1,500, while an Irish lace and silk ensemble carries a tag of over 2,000. She once said that, when I started, fashion was considered rather a frivolous thing, but I remember arriving in America to discover that it was the third greatest industry there. And when one thinks of enormous industries like cars and steel, you couldn't really sneeze at fashion. I remember asking her as delicately as possible during our conversation why she'd never married. I think I've had a lucky escape in being alone, she replied smoothly. I don't really think I've missed anything. I do love working. It fulfills me, and I've always been a happy person. We left it at that. It was hard not to be overwhelmed by her charm. Sometimes I pass her house in Merrion Square and I think what a destination it could have become for anyone interested in an Irish fashion success story, a great Irish female entrepreneur, a great gardener, and a woman who left her imprint on so many aspects of design.
You're just too marvelous for words like glorious, glamorous. In that old standby amorous, it's all too wonderful. I'll never find the words that say.
The land was opened around Rouen's well, so a ringfort appeared by the path, and a small lake below it, centred by a stand of reeds. We all marvelled at these brand new ancient things and cast regretful eyes along the raised hedgerow, the stumps of ash and oak. But what about it? There was plenty more trees, and more regrettable were all the years spent not knowing of the ringfort or the lake. The solitary farmer that had kept them secret was dead, and the distant cousin that fell in for the land was more given to openness, to views, to airy spaces. He was at the service this year, standing midway between the priest and the spring head, straddling the border between the patterned commonage and his inherited freehold. After the singing and the blessing, in that restless, uncertain time between the end of prayer and the start of gossip, he stepped forward from among the congregation. Tall and broad-shouldered, oblivious to the rising swarm of speculation, he lifted a cup of the cool water to his lips with a steady hand. A finger of evening sun touched the gold of his wedding band, then pointed in every direction at once as a dozen hearts sank. Stepping back from the sacred shore, he drew his hand across his lips and smiled as the next person passed. "God bless us," he said. "That water is sweet." His note was struck of spring and stone, of the earth beneath him, the vaulted sky above. We heard ourselves echoed in every syllable as he accepted the hands of the faithful, the grudging blossom of their regard, the gratitude of his new neighbours for the felled trees.
Nimona, the Pete Briquette, the famous TV ad showing children jostling for position in front of a cosy fire. And now, when climate change and public policy have put us sharply into reverse about fossil fuels, perhaps we can celebrate some other aspects of that past. As a young reporter, I was once sent to Dublin Airport to interview three dignitaries from the Soviet Union. They had come to learn something of the mechanics and economics of turf production, about which Bord Nimona at that time possibly knew more than any other enterprise in the world. I knew almost as little then about the Soviet Union as I did about turf production, but later I was to learn about some of the more unusual aspects of that industry, in unexpected ways and from unusual people. My first source was Jack McQuillan, that sturdy independent socialist, co-founder of the National Progressive Democrats with Noel Brown, and a gadfly who tormented Fianna Fáil governments in the early 1960s more successfully than many other opposition TDs. In an earlier career, he had been in the army, and as such was occasionally seconded to supervise turf cutting on one of the Midland bogs. His management style, he told me, was unique but highly productive. Instead of organising the turf cutters in shifts, he gave them quotas. Once they had achieved the quota, they were allowed to go home. It was as unusual a management theory then as it would be today, but it worked. My other source of information for a book I was later writing about RTE was a man who had a long journalistic career, including editorship of the Irish Press, and who later became a tough, no-nonsense head of news in RTE during the hectic early days of the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland. This was the journalist Jim McGuinness, a dairyman, whose early political life included a spell in the IRA, for which, along with others of similar tendencies, he had been interned for 2 years in the Curra. This aspect of his CV told against him on his release, as did his refusal to sign the undertaking required of many former internees to forswear any future involvement in militant republicanism. In later years, although his patriotism remained undimmed, he resigned from the physical force ideology, and his work as RTE's head of news was enhanced by a broad journalistic sensibility. This led him to insist that his reporters interviewed unionists as well as nationalists in the north. His initial period of post-internment employment, however, because of his record as an ex-internee, was in a relatively menial capacity on one of Bord Nimona's bogs. He had been in the manager's office one day, he told me, when the phone rang, and as there was no one else there, he answered it. At the other end of the phone was the then chairman of Bord Nimona, C.S. Todd Andrews, a veteran ex-Republican himself, who later became chairman of the RTE Authority. After a brief conversation, Andrews inquired about the identity of the person to whom he was speaking. When he heard that it was McGuinness, he asked him about the undertaking required of all ex-internees to abstain from political violence. "Are you the fella," he said, "who wouldn't sign that pledge after getting out of the Curra?" McGuinness agreed that indeed he was. There was a pause before Andrews responded with his traditional brusqueness. "Is that so?" he said. "I must say, I wouldn't sign the effing thing myself." Andrew's subsequent chairmanship of RTE began in 1966, the same year as Jim McGuinness's tenure as head of news ended, although he continued to work for RTE in other capacities until 1974. But if the government had thought that by appointing Andrews to chair the RTE authority they were hiring a safe pair of hands, they must have been occasionally discomforted by his unique combination of political loyalty and personal independence. Donal O'Moran, the founder of Gay Ling and a sometime member of the RTE authority, told me when I interviewed him for the same book that he had been in Andrew's RTE office one day when the phone rang. The person at the other end of the phone was Erskine Childers, then Minister for Posts and Telegraphs, who had rung to complain about the frequency with which members of Sinn Féin, at that time not yet banned from the airwaves, were being interviewed on radio and television. Andrews listened to the minister with barely concealed impatience, which finally got the better of him. "If your government locked them up, Erskine," he said bluntly, "there wouldn't be any of these problems."
In August, allotment gardeners in Ballyshannon, where I live, discovered that their vegetables were being fertilised by their 4,000-year-old ancestors. A Bronze Age site was uncovered, containing evidence of three types of burial that evolved over that dim and distant time in the face of the profound mystery of death. A flat carved grave capstone, an urn for cremated remains, and a pit burial. This discovery is a timely reminder that funeral and burial rites may evolve from time to time, but honouring the dead remains constant. Lately, we've shown resilience in finding new ways to say goodbye to our loved ones. Physically distant crowds lining the funeral procession route convey love and respect for the deceased. Virtual attendance at funeral services through live streaming helps fill the void left by restrictions. The Bronze Age burial site unearthed in August is just one of three remarkable finds here in Ballyshannon, Ireland's oldest town. There is also a 12th century graveyard containing over 1,000 graves and, closest to my heart, a cluster of stone-lined graves of 11 women dating from the 7th century. They are in Hugh John McGonigal's field by the coastline where I love to walk. The tender care of our dead and the beautiful hope that our spirits live on after our life force is spent was as real then as it is now. We see it in the pre-Christian community's careful choice of sacred locations to bury their dead, close to their gods who dwell where there is food and water. In the 12th century Christian graveyard, in keeping with the hope of resurrection, all bodies are placed to face the rising sun. Some have in their hands pieces of quartz, which, when rubbed together, produce a faint glow to banish the darkness. But it was the use by the BBC programme Meet the Ancestors in the late 1990s of facial reconstruction, then cutting-edge technology, which made one of the long-departed dead around me seem like a real person. In the episode The Lady of the Sands, the programme reconstructed the face of one of the 7th century women as she was in life and recreated the landscape in which she lived. When I walk along the shore now where my neighbour, still known as the Lady of the Sands, lived and died over 1,000 years ago, I see in my eye of the heart an elegant middle-aged woman of noble birth and distinctive good looks. Her only blemish is a sore and slightly drooping eye caused by a chronic inflammation of the tear gland. A groove has been worn into one of her front teeth by her repeatedly drawing the thread of flax through them when spinning. She wears a head covering and a simple woven dress secured with a decorative pin. Her home, a circular thatched hut with a central fire, is one of a group, a rath, with walls of woven wood insulated with straw and bracken. When she dies, her body is ceremoniously wrapped in a shroud of that same fine linen she wove. Over time, living memory of her life will fade away, as will ours. But through this remarkable programme, she, with her kindly face and sore eye, has been returned to us. The year after the archaeological dig at her grave, a fitting, a fleeting wreath appeared there, in the form of a shimmering blue carpet of tiny wild violas, whose dormant seeds had come back to life on the freshly disturbed soil. The grave site is now indistinguishable from the other fields around it, but I often see his guardian, Hugh John, there. He tells me that he goes to say a prayer for those whose remains still rest there. Why does he do it? Well, our ancestors may be dead for centuries, but as Hugh John says, they all belong to someone at some time.
On this morning's programme, we heard The Secret Gardens by Henrietta McCurvey, Napoli Bella by William Wall, Sybil Connolly, Ireland's Forgotten National Treasure by Deirdre McQuillan, At Rouen's Well by Donal Ryan, Turf Wars by John Horgan, and Lady of the Sands by Olive Travers. This morning's music began with Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite by The Beatles. Then we heard Santa Lucia sung by Enrico Caruso. Then Too Marvelous for Words by Johnny Mercer sung by Frank Sinatra. After that we heard From My Irish Sketchbook, The Rose Tree by Michelle Esposito, played on piano by Micheál O'Rourke. And finally, The Merino Waltz, played on fiddle by John Sheehan. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.